The current guidelines suggest that you should have multiple meal moments throughout the day. Kind of the opposite started happening. You saw more and more research in intermittent fasting. Theoretically, from a protein distribution point of view, should be very suboptimal. But even under suboptimal conditions, you really didn't see a detrimental effect of protein distribution.
Welcome to the Seemland podcast. Our guest today is Jorn Trommelen. Jorn is a PhD and assistant professor at the University of Maastricht in the Netherlands. Jorn and his colleagues published a very popular and interesting study about protein. They basically challenged the idea that you need to eat only 30 grams of protein in one sitting to build muscle. Jorn's study showed that even 100 grams of protein gets absorbed and utilized for protein synthesis. In this episode, we're going to talk about this study and also everything else related to protein metabolism, protein foods, and resistance training. Jorn, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you on the podcast because you and your colleagues published a few months ago, like in the end of 2023, a pretty like groundbreaking or yeah, like kind of remarkable study that refutes some of the previous findings in terms of protein synthesis and you know, how many grams of protein you can ingest in one meal. So yeah, I'm like pretty interested to talk with you about that study and everything else related to protein.
Yeah, that was a fun one.
Yeah, we can maybe start with that. So we can cover the main findings of that study and what are like some other, let's say, interesting nuances that we need to clarify. So like for people who don't or haven't heard about it before, then pretty much the study was done that you had 25 grams of protein ingested after workout versus 100 grams of protein. And what you found was that the 100 grams of protein yielded a much longer and greater anabolic, not anabolic response, but like the protein synthesis stayed elevated for longer.
Yeah, that is the basic setup of the study and the basic finding, but I'll quickly cover why we did the study in the first place. So in for example, in sports nutrition, the current guidelines suggest that you should have multiple meal moments throughout the day. So it's the concept of protein distribution. Ideally, you have like four, maybe even five moments where you consume about 25 grams of protein, because above that, it's thought that your efficiency, your use of the protein strongly declines and at some point even limits out. It just has no additional value. At that point, you would oxidize, so burn all the amino acids in your protein. You simply cannot build it into your tissues anymore. Now, I was skeptical of that for various reasons. One was when you look at long-term studies where people got different protein distribution patterns throughout the day, you don't really see a clear benefit from it. Now, that can be for various reasons. And for a long time, I thought, once we have more of those studies, we can combine them in a meta-analysis, and then you'll see that protein distribution has a benefit. But kind of the opposite started happening. You saw more and more research in intermittent fasting / time-restricted feeding, which should theoretically, from a protein distribution point of view, should be very suboptimal. But even under those suboptimal conditions, you really didn't see a detrimental effect of protein distribution. So then I started becoming more and more skeptical of that concept of protein distribution. Then mostly a fun fact, like not necessarily convincing on its own, but in nature, you have several animals who consume huge protein meals. Best example is a snake who can consume 25% of its body weight, which for guys like us would be the equivalent of eating about 50 steaks, 20 kilograms of steak. So I like steak, but nowhere near that amount. But when a snake consumes such a big meal, you, and some research has been done on this, they digest their meal for days and their protein synthesis stays elevated for days. So it's not completely out of the picture that maybe other species have the same principle. Because I kind of had like, some practical experience, let's call it that, where in the middle of the night, I once woke up, had to pee, and I just felt that I was still digesting my food. I kind of had like a meat burp. And I was like, well, I had a barbecue like 8 hours ago. I just feel I'm still digesting this food. So that made me critical of those studies because those earlier studies, they just measured anabolism, muscle protein synthesis for like 4, max 6 hours after a meal. But if I just feel I'm still digesting the food, if it's still in my gut, all that protein can't possibly have reached my muscle and be built into muscle tissue. So I got the basic idea. If you have a large amount of protein, of course, it takes more time to be digested. And after it's digested, it's absorbed, then it's released in the circulation. Only then can it be taken up and built into tissues. So if you want to study larger doses, you simply have to measure longer. That's what we did. And only under those circumstances, then you see that these large doses indeed do have a benefit.
Yeah, it's kind of been my experience as well that at least like having this less frequent meals and larger amounts of protein in those meals hasn't like made me not build muscle over the course of long period of time. Like obviously I'm not like some sort of bodybuilder or physique athlete, but you know, when I started doing intermittent fasting about 10 years ago, I weighed like 67 kilograms or something. I was 18 then, and now I'm like, or the peak or the highest I've been was like 85 lean with abs. So like it's, and all the time I've done some form of intermittent fasting, whether that be like the 16 and 8 method of fasting 16 hours and eating within 8 hours and having two meals, or even like one meal a day as well in some cases. And I've like never like not seen like a long-term plateau. Like once the training is there and you eat total amount of protein, a sufficient amount of total protein, then at least from my own experience as well, like it you know, the progress is obviously slower maybe a little bit, but it's still like there.
Everyone's always asking me, what do I put into my protein shake? I'll tell you exactly what. It's 30 grams of whey protein, 10 grams of collagen, and 1 teaspoon of raw cacao. I blend it up with water and ice cubes, and it becomes incredibly creamy. Whey protein is the most bioavailable protein source in the world. Many studies have found that whey protein supplementation improves muscle growth and strength when combined with resistance training. Whey protein stimulates muscle protein synthesis 31% more than soy protein and 132% more than casein after resistance training. Whey protein also promotes glutathione production, which is the body's main antioxidant that supports immunity. The brand of whey protein I use, Nordcode, has pure organic whey from grass-fed cows from the Alps. It's the highest quality and cleanest whey protein in the world. I combine it with a Nordcode Complete Collagen that has added glycine, which is beneficial for joints and skin health. Nordcode also has organic raw cacao with lion's mane and chaga extracts, which improves cardiovascular health and energy. All of this for only 250 calories, over 30 grams of protein to maximize protein synthesis, and 10 grams of collagen for skin anti-aging benefits. If you're allergic to dairy, then Nordcoat also has plant-based protein powder made from pea, hemp seed, and rice protein with added MCTs and maca. You can get a 10% discount by using the code SEAM10 at livehealthy.com/collections/Nordcoat.
Yeah, so initially I thought protein distribution is probably not going to make all that much difference either way, but you know, there might be relatively small benefit, but as more and more research comes out, including this study, obviously, I think if there's a benefit from, you know, following the guidelines, it's extremely minimal and it might really not be there at all.
Yeah, and then it comes to like the practical standpoint, you know, if you don't need to have four meals and you don't need to carry the Tupperware with you or something, then it kind of gives you a lot more freedom to just have, you know, two or three meals, larger meals per day.
So what's interesting there is that previously I've done several studies on pre-sleep feeding. And then athletes were like, okay, pre-sleep feeding, I understand. You want more protein, you want to distribute it better during the day. But there's still a long period between that pre-sleep feeding and breakfast the next morning. Should I wake up in the middle of the night to again have a protein shake? So that concept of protein distribution throughout the day, and you know, really have an alarm and eat every 4 hours. In yeah, some bodybuilding circles, it's like really their religion, so to speak, and their dedication is impressive. But it seems like it's really not necessary.
One thing I want to touch upon immediately is one of the bigger criticism that your study got, that you use the milk protein, which is much lower to digest than whey protein. And also, like, the argument is that 25 grams of milk protein or casein that is in the milk protein, then that's not sufficient to maximize the protein synthesis response anyway. So just having more than 25 grams or like over 40 grams of milk protein would be already giving more, would be giving better results than 25 grams anyway. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so first of all, I'm always happy when people are skeptical of studies. That's what they should be. But at the same time, it's always funny that no matter what you do, people always say, yeah, but you should have done this. Of course, we thought about which type of protein to use, and we very intentionally used milk protein for a variety of reasons. One is entirely methodological and kind of boring, but we infused a lot of tracers in a cow, therefore we could make like special protein that allowed us to measure basically 50 things instead of just two things in the study. So we just had a lot more measurements. But that's entirely just a methodological issue. The second reason is that in the Western world, dairy protein has the biggest contribution to total protein intake. So I knew people were going to say, yeah, does this translate to other proteins? Well, the question is more, do other proteins translate to milk protein because this one has the biggest contribution? Nevertheless, let's answer that question. Does it translate to other proteins? Well, in practice, most people get their protein from whole food mixed meals. Those are going to be relatively slowly digesting because of the caloric content of the meal, because of the fiber content. So the fact that we had milk protein, which is 20% whey protein, which is fast digestible, 80% casein, which is slowly digestible. So overall, milk is a relatively slowly digestible protein that better represents how people consume most of their food, namely slowly, than if we would have done whey protein. Now, then the final question, would whey protein not simply be a more effective protein than casein, which is something our lab has done a lot of research on, so I know the literature pretty well. There's been exactly eight studies on that compared whey with casein, and only two found a significantly higher stimulation of muscle protein synthesis with whey protein, while six found no significant difference. So a lot of people have this idea that whey is much better than casein. It's not really supported with the literature. And in fact, I think people there kind of miss an important lesson from this study. A lot of those studies have measured muscle protein synthesis over a pretty short period as well, which means that the whey gut, which is fast digestible, had the chance to do its entire magic, so to speak, while the casein is usually still digesting at the end of the study. So it hasn't gotten enough time to do its magic. So I think if you measure longer, even in the studies where it now seems, those two studies where it seems that whey is better, I think that difference would become even smaller. But so just to summarize, this is the protein biggest contribution. Is pretty slow, which better reflects most normal meals, how we eat, and would be whey not be more effective, minimally at best.
Yeah, gotcha. So it's not as big of a problem as some people think it is that you use the casein, and it actually is more like applicable to the real world, in
Yeah,
that sense. That
if
is.
we would have just measured for 4 hours, I think the 100 grams of whey would have beaten 100 grams of casein pretty badly. But every additional hour, the casein is starting to catch up because it needs its time to do its magic. So, this whole
Yeah.
concept of you should measure long enough so you capture the entire response, that has simply been neglected in a lot of studies. It's been neglected in dose response studies, as well as in fast versus slow studies.
Yeah. Yeah, because like whey would increase the protein synthesis very fast, and but it comes down faster as well, whereas the casein will stay elevated for much longer.
Yeah.
And but would it be like, okay, what is the situation where it's good to have this bigger spike versus like a longer time under the curve? So like
Good,
older
good
people who are.
question. So, like now we're getting in the small little details that will add up to very little practical benefit, but nevertheless, it's interesting to discuss. Theoretically, you want the faster digestible proteins throughout the day when you know you're going to have your next meal soon anyway, because you have the big spike, and the fact that then it's gone doesn't really matter because you'll have your next meal. So theoretically, you could argue you want a very large dose of whey, and then 4 hours later, another very large dose of whey, 4 hours later again. Theoretically, that could still be better. But even when we look at this study with pretty slow digesting protein, like there's trying to go above this in terms of protein synthesis rates, like it's already so high, like you're in the range of incremental gains. And then again, you're back to the, oh, maybe protein distribution matters more if you have very fast digestible protein. So one, you would start living on protein shakes. Then you're back to the setting your timer every, let's say, 4 hours for probably a very small gain. My guess would be even if that concept would work, that time and effort, there's probably other things you can do either in the gym or just relaxation. Think your time is better spent elsewhere.
Yeah, for sure. But what is like then, let's for someone who is like really trying to like micromanage their muscle gains and the protein synthesis, so like what is the research right now of like how many meals is maximum benefits? Like is it like the 6, 8 meals like the bodybuilders do, or for yeah, like for the average person, what is the maximum frequency in general that is the most beneficial?
Yeah, so pretty much the main takeaway from this study is whatever meal you have, how big that should be determines on when your next meal is. So if you know you're going to have your next meal in 4 hours, 25 grams is not that bad. Could you get a slightly higher spike? Yes, that's what this study says. Okay, so maybe you go a little bit higher, you go 40, and then 4 hours later you have your next meal. Now, if you know you won't have your next meal in, say, 6 to 8 hours, go higher. If you know I won't eat for 12 hours, you might want to go for 100 grams. So that's the main lesson. It's just your dose depends on your next meal. Now, if you start with a blank slate where an athlete just says, tell me what to do for optimal muscle protein synthesis, then again, I could make an argument you still kind of want to have some protein distribution in your day in combination with fast digestible protein. If you look at muscle metabolism entirely from a protein slash amino acid angle, but I don't think that's what you should do because as soon as you start eating other foods, that would slow everything down anyway. And of course, you want tons of other foods. You want the micronutrients, you want other macronutrients. So because of that, your meals will always be slow because all those other nutrients will slow it down. So this concept of frequent spikes of fast digestible protein is simply not practical. So I would recommend people, like their first goal is to hit their daily protein intake. If they, depending on their lifestyle, if they can distribute it, why not? You don't, like it's definitely not worse. If for other reasons, maybe for convenience, you do time-restricted feeding, maybe for some other potential health benefits, you do intermittent feeding, you don't have to freak out, you'll lose gains. Just make sure that that daily target is hit in that one window. But if a bodybuilder says, no, all I care about is optimizing my muscle mass gains, I would still recommend the distribution just for the simple reason there's no potential negative benefit. And like my study was not designed to say, see, one big meal is just as good as multiple. All we know that the main argument for protein distribution is simply not true that, ooh, if you eat more than 20 grams, you burn it all. So the evidence supporting protein distribution, very weak, I would say. But then again, if your goal is to optimize things, why would you not try it? It's not that difficult. If you don't want to do protein distribution, you're probably not missing out on much, if anything.
And like maybe like one massive meal probably isn't the most optimal for muscle maximum muscle growth. So you like at least two or two meals, maybe like a snack or something, and that is probably still better than like one massive meal.
Well, one massive meal is not necessarily a whole lot of fun. We did some pilot studying, of course, to see how much protein you can eat in a meal. And then the second part is, especially if you're an athlete, one meal isn't necessarily a whole lot of fun. Like, you still want to train and you don't want to really do it, or often you don't want to do it on an empty stomach, but you're also not going to train an hour after you just ate, let's say, 100 grams of protein. So at least two meals in practice, even if you do intermittent fasting, you probably still have kind of two meals at the beginning and end of your feeding window.
Gotcha. And what is the total amount of protein then per day that, based on the research, like is the maximum benefits, and what is like the lower ceiling that you want to hit for muscle growth?
So that is still highly debated. If I ignore the muscle growth part for a second, it's pretty clear that you don't need that much protein to not disappear. So we call that the protein requirement. So the recommended daily allowance is 0.8 grams per kilogram per day, which is very little. And in fact, most, like, let's say healthy young guys like us, naturally already eat more than that. So without worrying about your protein intake, most healthy young individuals eat enough to not lose any protein mass. Now, of course, that's probably not what your audience is interested in. They want to optimize health and or physical function. Now, a number that you often hear is 1.6 gram per kilogram per day, based on a meta-analysis that may optimize muscle mass gains. I think that number is a good starting point to start thinking of what the optimal protein intake could be, but that meta-analysis on its own is not that convincing. If you just look at the pattern of the data, it's not that you see, like, oh, clearly above that, there's no more benefits. Second of all, it's based on self-reported intake, which is usually underreported in studies. So even if that analysis was spot on, it's probably higher than that simply based on the unreporting. So if someone, depending on how motivated and how much effort they're willing to put into optimizing everything, I would say up to 2 grams per kilogram body mass per day. But again, I really see it as a spectrum. It's not like, oh, I eat 1.6, then this happens. Oh, I eat 1.2, this happens. Training will by far be the number one determinant whether or not you're gaining muscle mass, and protein will slightly help you either way. I'm obsessed with protein, but it's unlikely that for most individuals, protein is either causing you to plateau or you're breaking through your plateau. Training is just incredibly much more powerful.
Yeah, and your study actually also did it after a workout, the protein ingestion. So yeah, like how yeah, like you said, the training is more important kind of even.
Yeah, so it's pretty clear that muscles, like how much, so you consume protein, it's digested in your gut, then absorbed in the gut, then released in the circulation, from there taken up in tissues like muscle tissues, and then once it's taken up, it still needs to be built into muscle tissue, and that last part is called muscle protein synthesis. Now, if I give 20 grams of protein to a subject, how much of that protein ends up into muscle tissue? Any clue? Let's say I just give a random person, pick someone from the street, just has a normal life, doesn't go to the gym. I give them 20 grams of normal protein, let's say whey protein. Any guess how much of that 20 grams ends up in muscle tissue? Is it less than a gram? Is it 1 gram? Is it half the protein? Is it 90%?
For a completely sedentary person, I would suggest maybe I don't know, 10%.
Oh, that's perfect. Like if you were faking your guess and you knew it, that was the exact number. Then you're
Okay.
then one, you know it well, and two, you're a great actor. No, it's exactly that for a healthy young person. It seems to be about 10%. However, if you exercise, it goes to 15 and potentially even more percent. So that's, well, it sounds like, oh, that's just a 5% difference, but that's 50% more than 10%, right? So
Right.
either 2 grams goes in or 3 grams goes in. So that's a huge difference. And the reverse is also true. For example, I'm pretty focused on sports nutrition. That's what I think is most fun. But a lot of my colleagues try to investigate other muscle-related topics. For example, when someone breaks a leg, has a cast, then they see that in a week they lose like 2 kilograms of muscle from that leg, which is absurd. Like, good luck training 2 kilogram in one muscle leg. So they're trying to investigate how can we slow down muscle loss. Now, then an obvious thought is, well, you obviously can't train your broken leg. Can we supplement protein to slow down muscle loss? And it doesn't really work because it's not like that muscle has low physical activity that you're walking around. No, it has no physical activity because it's in a cast. And as a result, your body or that specific muscle is no longer actively taking up the amino acids and building it into the muscle. So you really see the effectiveness of protein is dependent on your physical activity level. So it's not really a battle like which one is more important, exercise or amino acids, because I could easily argue the opposite. You can train all you want. If you're not allowed to eat protein, you cannot grow because you cannot build tissues out of air. You need the building blocks. But the opposite is also true. If you're not allowed to move at all, your muscles just cannot build in those amino acids. That signal of physical activity determines how much of the ingested protein actually gets built in.
Yeah, that's very true. Like, and even like bodybuilders, I've seen some studies where obviously they're training hard, but their protein intake is pretty small compared to like what is recommended. So I think it's like 0.7 and 0.8 grams per kilogram or something like that, and they still like maintain the muscle. They obviously won't be able to like build a lot, but it goes to show that like even for maintaining like the training stimulus is like by far like the biggest most powerful thing.
Yeah.
Well, we talked about distribution, we talked about amounts. So now let's talk about like the types of the protein. So milk protein is obviously, like you said, very common in the diet. So what is the differences between, let's say, we can dissect them into like different groups. First, we can talk about, you know, animal versus plant-based proteins, and then maybe some of the details more of like, okay, meat versus cottage cheese or like milk protein and something like that.
Yeah, so in general, you can say that animal-based protein is more efficient than plant-based protein. Now, why is that? It's for a variety of reasons. The easiest is to think of like, what is protein doing that's useful for the muscle? And it's kind of two things. It delivers the building blocks for muscle, specifically the essential amino acids. You have to get them from your diet. And it's not just the building blocks, those essential amino acids, and in particular, leucine also acts as a signal. So just as training kind of is a trigger for muscle protein synthesis, leucine does that as well. Of course, that is nowhere near as strong as a resistance training bout. It's not like, ooh, I'm consuming a little bit of leucine and that replaces my training, but the underlying principle is the same. Now, when you think of it like that, you can kind of think of the quality of a protein depends on whether its amino acid composition is what the muscle needs for muscle growth. So that is the essential amino acid. Well, one, how much essential amino acids are in the protein? There you see that animal-based proteins in general have a higher percentage as essential amino acids than the plant-based protein. So that's one reason they're slightly more effective. Then leucine is one of the essentials, so that signal function also is a little bit higher. Then the third reason is that in general, animal-based proteins digest better. So it's nice that there's a certain composition of building blocks in your protein, but if they don't come into your body, it's useless. You just poop them out again. Technically, just to be technically correct, you don't poop them out. Your microbiota would use them, but they're not coming into your body, to your muscles. So the combination of all those factors results that with, if you have an equal amount of plant and animal protein, there's just either a suboptimal spectrum of essential amino acids. So quick analogy, if you're trying to build a house and you have five windows and five doors and 20 million bricks, you can't build that many houses because you run out of doors, probably the first thing, even though you have enough bricks to build like a whole city. It's the same with protein synthesis. You need all the essential amino acids in a specific composition, and the composition is just often off with plant-based protein. Now, there it is important to note that is mostly true when you eat like one protein source. If you eat like five different plant-based protein sources, then on average, that tends to average out. And so that's called complementary proteins. The more different ones you eat, on average, the entire quality of the meal goes up. Then again, it really depends on the digestibility of the protein. Of course, plant-based protein, it's not difficult to imagine, has a lot more fiber. Of course, fiber is super healthy. I'm absolutely not telling people to avoid it, but it does result in lower protein absorption, for example. Now, having said all that, this sounds like, oh no, being a vegetarian or a vegan, you're never going to gain any muscle mass. Doesn't work like that. In the end, again, your goal is to deliver sufficient amounts of all the individual essential amino acids to your muscle. And with plant-based protein, you just have to eat a little bit more to compensate for that. So it's absolutely possible to optimize muscle mass and recovery as a vegan. The easiest way is just to supplement with a little bit of plant-based protein. One, that's the easiest way to have a high protein intake. Number two, because it's a powder, it's highly digestible. It doesn't have that issue of fiber. So, last thing I'll say about this is that for every problem there is always in nutrition, there's usually a solution. And often people have like this agenda, like, oh, animals are better or plants are better, and that's the way it is. No, when you look at this topic, yes, animals are more effective. But there's solutions to fix that if you want to be a plant only eater.
Yeah, like a quantity is a quality of its own. I think it's a quote. Like if you have sufficient amount of whatever of all the amino acids, then it doesn't matter if they individually they're lower quality because the quantity is what matters at the end. Like getting just
It
sufficient amount
compensates
of
for it.
the
And that's the same principle as the study we just discussed. The bigger your meal is, the longer you'll be digesting it. So the amount of protein compensates for the frequency because you'll be digesting it for longer. It's really the same principle that amount compensates for almost everything. We joke that we can retire now because we just show doesn't matter what your goal is, just eat more protein and all the details like quality and distribution then kind of become irrelevant.
So like yeah, because like casein is also like lower quality than whey in some sense, I think.
It's slightly lower, but it's still relatively high. It's pretty high in essential amino acids and its digestibility. So just to clarify, digestibility is defined as how much of the protein will ultimately be absorbed. That is pretty high for casein, like close to 95%. It just needs very long. So the speed of digestion doesn't really matter for that principle. With plant proteins, depending on How usually the more processed plant proteins are, the higher quality they are. That's why protein powder, which is very processed, actually has a high quality from a protein metabolism point of view. But with whole food plant nutrition, digestibility can be 60%. And you can see 60 and 95, that's a huge difference. So you have to eat a lot more of the plant protein to compensate for that.
Yeah. So, pea protein concentrate or isolate or something like that, they're in some sense higher quality protein than even whole foods, animal-based
Yeah,
protein, because
absolutely.
they, yeah.
But it's of course important to say there, that's just looking from protein metabolism point of view.
Yeah.
That ignores that the whole food will have a lot of micronutrients that are beneficial. So just want to make sure that people don't mix those two. I'm not
Yeah.
saying that everyone should just eat protein powders.
Yeah, but it can certainly help if you're struggling with reaching the total protein intake, or if you are eating, let's say,
So
lower quality
especially
proteins.
the especially vegans, for example, they are not typically struggling with their micronutrients. So they are the group who can easily say, oh, my only challenge is, for example, protein intake. They can easily take multiple scoops of protein powder because they already hit their micronutrients.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, like vegan bodybuilders probably are taking protein powder, but the regular vegans probably aren't.
Yeah, so what I see a little bit is like, I think slowly there's more and more attention for plant-based nutrition, which in general I would say is not a bad movement for, let's say general health and sustainability. It's not as black and white that it's always better, but let's say it is. It's a small move towards the right direction, I think. But what I'm a little bit skeptical of is that. If you know what you're doing with nutrition, you can be a very healthy vegan or vegetarian. But I don't like that a lot of vegans and vegetarians, they try to convince other people to become vegan and vegetarian, but those people are not as passionate about nutrition. So they just blindly, okay, I'll stop eating meat. And then they start getting deficiency in, for example, protein, but also other nutrients. So let's say educated vegans, they are probably doing pretty well health-wise. But if I would tell my parents you have to become vegan because otherwise poor animals or poor environment or whatever, it would hurt their health because they just won't have enough knowledge to compensate for the potential downfalls of a plant-based diet. So knowledge is very important there.
Yeah, like if you're like a health optimizer or whatever, or bodybuilder, then you're probably more like, yeah, aware of the pitfalls and other things.
Yep.
One question I have is, so if you have less protein but you add the amino acids separately, would it make up for like a lower quantity of protein, or do you still need like a total amount of protein? So, for example, if you're, eating only below what is like recommended for the total protein intake, but you add extra amino acids into there, are you still getting the same effect, or do you still need to get the total amount of protein as well?
No, so from again from a protein metabolism point of view, the amino acids on their own are just as good, and if anything, slightly better than protein. Why are they slightly better? Is because they are by definition 100% digested, so digestibility is not an issue at all. So when you compare it to, say, milk protein, like 5% of the ingested protein simply will never be absorbed into your body. With free amino acids, they are pretty much always 100% absorbed. So technically, they're slightly more efficient than even high quality protein. So you can just count them towards your protein intake. Of course, when you take a free amino acid supplement, they have no other micronutrients. So am I recommending you should replace a very large proportion of your protein with amino acid supplements? Probably not. But just looking at it from a protein metabolism point of view, you can absolutely do that. And theoretically, could be slightly more efficient. Will that translate to any meaningful difference in performance or muscle mass? Probably not. But theoretically slightly more efficient.
Gotcha. Yeah, it might be like for those who struggle with eating the protein, maybe more useful for them.
Yeah, so coming back to my colleagues who, for example, do research on intensive care, that are pretty much people laying in a coma, fighting for their life, massive inflammation everywhere. Their gut is hardly moving because the body doesn't even know what's going on. There, they typically give essential amino acids because then digestion is much easier. Likewise, yeah, if someone, what I often hear is that some people just struggle to eat first thing in the morning. And there, for example, a free amino acid supplement could be a good way because you just wash it away. It doesn't feel heavy on the stomach because it just flies through it, essentially.
Gotcha. And I think, I'm not sure if you, I think I recalled in your study, you mention the caveat that it might not be a more optimal strategy for the elderly people, if I'm not mistaken, of having like, because the elderly are more vulnerable to like muscle breakdown, and it's harder for them to build muscle tissue or stimulate protein synthesis. So is this kind of strategy of having just, you know, two large meals a day valid for the elderly as well, or is it more for like the younger individuals?
Yeah, so that would require speculation. What we clearly know about elderly is what we discussed earlier is how much protein ends up in muscle tissue, for example. That percentage is lower in elderly adults compared to younger adults. So their muscle are just less efficient at using protein. However, there is some suggestion that for that reason, elderly simply need more protein, that a higher amount of protein makes up for their lower sensitivity. We kind of come back to the same theme. Like if you have an issue, increase protein amount to compensate for it. Now, important caveat, that principle doesn't always work. Like, oh, just have more protein to overpower whatever issue you have. For example, we discussed the immobilization, so not using a muscle at all. That is one scenario where more protein simply is not effective. Your body just says no movement. I don't know what to do with this protein. But in elderly, it seems that there's at least good mechanistic evidence that more protein is beneficial. When you look at longer term data, it's kind of a mix. There's not that really convincing evidence that just more protein is helping older adults either maintain or build muscle mass. But when combined with exercise, there is pretty convincing evidence. So older adults who still, hit the gym maybe twice a week, their protein is pretty effective. If you're not going to the gym, then, well, I don't think you have to worry about protein distribution because your protein is not going to do a whole lot anyway.
Right. Yeah. So yeah, like I mean, the elderly will still experience the sarcopenia and frailty if they're not lifting weights.
Yeah,
Doesn't matter how
yeah.
much
So
protein they're
again,
eating.
physical, like just as we say that with in young athletes, your training is determining like 90% of your gains, so to speak. But elderly, it's the same. Like they don't have to go to the gym 5 times a week to maintain their body mass, but just trying to have 2 reasonable workouts a week is probably more important than their overall protein intake. And ironically, once you go to the gym like 2 times a week as an older adult, at that point, protein intake starts becoming rewarding. So it's really that synergy that you want to see.
Yeah. One interesting let's say topic is also like carbohydrates, in my opinion, because in some sense, like, or at least I th what I've seen is like insulin can also have very powerful effects on muscle growth. And if you, because obviously people eat more than just protein, they eat fats and carbs there. So like, does the carbohydrates and insulin have any like enhancing effects on the protein synthesis, or any like other ways of affecting the spike or the curve or something like that?
Yeah, so my first publication ever was about insulin, so it's always a topic that's near to my heart. It's pretty clear that insulin in normal situations, and I'll expand on that in a second, does not stimulate muscle protein synthesis. What is an not normal situation? If you inject it at super high levels, I'm not saying like double what someone's body has, I say like 100 times higher than what someone's body has, then in one local muscle, like you can only if do it in a local muscle because you do it in your entire body, your blood glucose drops and you die. Then you can stimulate muscle protein synthesis, but effectively you're starting to use it as a steroid. If you just give people a little bit of insulin or you give them carbohydrates, there is no effect of insulin on muscle protein synthesis. However, there is a quite clear effect of insulin on muscle protein breakdown. Now, that's a complicated topic, but I'll give you the short version is if you have a little bit of an increase in insulin, you see about a 50%, so 50 reduction in protein breakdown. So that's huge, but you don't need that much insulin for it. And once you have that reduction, more insulin isn't helping. So you need a little bit of insulin and you instantly have the maximum effect. So in practice, it's not really something you have to focus on because 20 grams of protein alone, for example, would already give you enough insulin to maximally reduce that muscle protein breakdown. So if we make this practical, do you need carbohydrates for insulin as a signal? No, it would only impact muscle protein breakdown, but your protein alone gives that signal already. However, does that mean I'm saying you don't have to eat carbs at all? Of course not. But that's through a different mechanism. It's not because of insulin, but basically your body is tracking whether you're starving or not. And you see that if I just, let's say you're my subject and I just give you a little bit of protein, boom, muscle protein synthesis goes up, no problem. However, after just 5 days of caloric restriction, you start seeing that your muscle protein synthesis is going down. And it seems that your body is pretty much realizing, okay, we're slowly starting to starve. Maybe investing in more tissue mass, this highly metabolic active tissue mass, that's not the priority for survival. That is a priority when you have enough calories and you're training super hard. Then it's like, okay, how do I survive next week? Build more muscle mass. But when you're starving, the priority is more like, okay, let's not starve even more. Let's not invest our precious calories in building more tissue that will only require more calories. So you absolutely need calories, whether that's from fat or carbohydrates. You don't need them in every single meal. But if over a period of several days, your body starts noticing, oh, we're in a negative energy balance, then muscle protein synthesis rates will go down. But tomorrow, if all you eat is protein, it will have zero impact on your muscle protein synthesis rate. You just can't keep doing that trick every single day.
Right. So it just like regulates other hormones like IGF-1 and testosterone that also have this like abundance signal to the body that hey,
Yeah,
you
so
can.
with calorie restriction, everything starts getting dysregulated. And if you look at the hormone levels from bodybuilders who don't use steroids, they are like their testosterone, everything is like super low. Often they can't even get an erection, just as a simple example.
Yeah, so like having the abundance signal from carbs and insulin is like one small hack kind of that enables to like maintain higher hormones during like a calorie restricted state.
Essentially, yeah. So I don't see it as maintaining a higher one. It's just if you don't have them, it will start dropping very, very fast. But in practice, it will always drop if you are trying to lower your body fat. But if you just go too low in them, you're just accelerating that principle. Yeah.
What do you think about these super high protein diets, like over 2 grams per kilogram, like 2.4, 2.5 grams? per kilogram usually used in like when people are trying to lose weight. So they're like just reducing the carbs and reducing the fat and jacking up the protein and eating like 50% protein almost.
I'm somewhat skeptical of that. Like, I've not really seen convincing evidence. Like, above 2 grams is really, you're starting to get very high numbers. As much as I love protein, I'm skeptical that that really matters. And I don't really see the benefit once you're at that 2 grams already. Just give them a little bit of carbohydrate. Like, for the fat loss, it's mostly the calorie content that matters. And the evidence that, like, there's clearly some evidence that protein is relatively satiety, it like suppresses hunger. But that's not linear. And oh, more protein, you suppress hunger much better than 1 gram of carbohydrate or an equal amount of calories. Yeah, I have not seen, it's not my expertise. I'm not reading every single study on that, but from what I've seen, I've not really seen convincing evidence that that's the best approach. And even if it was the best approach, it's probably better to do a slightly more moderate macronutrient profile so that the person just learns basic nutrition principles and rather think of it as this is a short-term diet where I do this extreme thing and then I can go back to normal. No, it's better to have teach them the basics of nutrition, and otherwise they're going to think of carbohydrates and fat as enemies the rest of their life, and that's not helpful either.
I guess the reason why people do it is that the argument at least is that like a higher like a much higher protein intake in a calorie deficit is going to maintain more muscle. But like you already said, like the insulin or the small amount of carbs can also do the same effect almost.
Yeah, and when you look at studies with higher protein intake, there's just no convincing evidence that anything above 2 grams is going to have. In fact, there's no real convincing evidence that anything above 1.6 gram per kilogram per day is having benefits. Although, as we discussed, I think that 1.6 grams in practice means you're eating 2 grams because people underreport. But higher than that, there's just no evidence to support that. Now, again, you have to be pragmatic. If you're very scared about losing and you think it helps, I'm not saying you shouldn't do it, but don't do it because, oh, it's definitely going to help. If you think it works, play around with it, no issue. But yeah, it's not what the evidence shows. It's not what I expect, and you might set yourself up with just an unhealthy relationship with, oh, these macronutrients are enemies, and I don't know if that's best for long-term healthy eating.
Gotcha. Yeah, I agree. Like moderation, like learning to not learning to suffer, but learning to practice moderation is much more important in some sense because, you know, if you're trying to return to a normal way of eating and normal like lifestyle, then you need to have some moderation or have to have like the ability to practice moderation rather than being like this on and off kind of like eating disorder.
So I would say I'm a pretty disciplined person in most areas of my life, but if I eat an Oreo, I kind of want to eat the whole package. And I feel that behavior, if you really told yourself like, no, carbohydrates are evil, only protein is good, and then you have some carbohydrate in some context, people are like, okay, I failed today. Today doesn't count. I'm going to eat all the carbohydrates and I try again tomorrow. And it just sets you up for this, bad habits, I think.
One final thing I want to cover is from the exercise component. So, like machines versus free weights. Are there any like better response from a protein synthesis perspective when you're using the compound lifts versus like the machines?
Yeah, so there's been a few studies, not specifically on muscle protein synthesis, but on muscle mass gains. And those suggest no real difference between machines versus free weights, which is kind of what I would expect. In practice, I would say that people who use free weights gain little bit better than people in the machines if I just look around in the gym. But I think that's mostly selection bias, that if you're serious, you kind of want to learn to squat, you want to learn how to bench, you want to learn how to do a pull-up. While machines, people who just want to play it safe and want to do some physical activity and definitely never want to get hurt. So I think it's more selection bias than one is better than the other. So some advantages, at least theoretical, of free weights is that it just better translate to daily movement. Use a little bit m maybe more like stabilizing functions. The drawback is because there's more stabilization required, it's maybe a little bit easier to not hit the same intensity because something else might give in. So it kind of has pros and cons. But if you just care about muscle mass gains, at least the studies suggest there's no real difference. If there's a difference, it's probably minimal. But again, I feel that if you go into the squat rack, you start knowing the other people in the squat rack who are on average pretty dedicated people, and you just go, you become part of the gym that lifts more serious. So I really think there is a benefit trying to do it in practice, but it's just selection bias and the people you hang out with in a gym. If you just train in your home and you have machines versus say a squat rack, I don't think it makes any meaningful difference.
Yeah, it's like the person who goes to the gym for like the first time, or even like, these not very regular gym goers, they're not going to do the squat more likely. They're more likely to do the machines because it's kind of easier, like lower barrier to entry and safer perspective.
But another example is I've never seen anyone walk up to someone and say like, ah, good work on the leg extensions, man. Good job, bro. And then they start talking about training stuff. Well, in squats, like, oh, it's a, impressive squat. How much are you lifting? Oh, what training program? So you see that the people who are in the weight lifting section, let's call it that is just a more serious group, and you kind of become part of a more serious lifting group, so to speak. But it's not, that's entirely behavioral and not physiological that there would be differences in muscle mass gains.
Yeah, but it's funny, like when you look at the absolute like pro bodybuilders, then most of them are using machines because they can directly target the specific muscles, so it's like kind of a bell curve almost.
Yeah, and then, well, then you have like, let's call it I'm very passionate about protein. Some people are extremely passionate about optimal exercise execution, and then like all they do is analyze like which exercise, where is the optimal moment arm, and with cables they try to have a set with the optimal torque in this angle, and then a set with the optimal torque at peak contraction. So you can make exercise science as complicated as you want. The question is just how much of a difference is gonna make. Studies suggest little to no, to nothing. But if it's your passion, by all means, do it.
Yeah, for sure. Well, yeah, this has been very interesting, and I think many people got a weight off their shoulder knowing that they don't have to eat four times a day and they can eat larger meals. But yeah, it's been great talking with you. Before I ask my last question, where can people learn more about you and your work?
Well, on Twitter, people can find me by my name, which I'm not going to say because they'll never remember it. Maybe it's in the title somewhere, but everywhere else, I'm at Nutrition Tactics. Used to be very active. I kind of need to get back to it, but so much things to do in science, and I'll try to pick it up again. So that's at Nutrition Tactics.
Awesome. Sounds like we'll put the links in the description. But yeah, my last question is, what's this one piece of advice or a habit that you wish you adopted sooner?
I would say I tell people that I believe that sleep is the most productive thing you can do. So I'm not saying you can never wake up 2 hour earlier because you have to study for an exam or because you want to hit the gym or whatever, because you don't want to mess up your training cycle. Like sometimes it's okay to sacrifice your sleep because it messes up something else. But I would say that in because then you care more about one specific area, but in general, that 2 hours of sleep would have been worth more. Like your hormone levels would a little bit better, your mood would be a little bit better. If you just look into the sleep research, like every aspect of your life becomes a little bit better. And because it has impacts like every aspect of your life, altogether, that's just a bigger effect than what 2 hours in the gym or a healthy meal or fun watching Netflix. So yeah, I truly believe that sleep is the most productive. It's not for lazy people. It's the most productive thing you can do.
Yeah, and it's also very anabolic or
Absolutely.
anti-catabolic.
Well, so there's I'll keep it short, but there's like one of my favorite studies. I wish I did it, where there were people, same amount of calories on a university. Essentially, subjects were like locked up in the university. All the food was provided to them, so the researchers knew exactly what they ate. It was not like, ooh, maybe it was something else. No, everything was controlled in the study. Both groups were put on a diet. The only difference was how much the groups were allowed to sleep, and you saw that both groups lost the same amount of weight during the diet. Just one group lost mostly fat mass and very little lean mass. That was obviously the group that slept a lot. And the other group lost the same amount, but it was a much larger percentage lean mass and a lot less fat mass. And it was so well controlled, really, the only possible explanation was the sleep.
Yeah, I mean, if you're just deliberately restricting the sleep, then you're making it much harder for yourself.
Absolutely. And most people, they have what we call, I think it's called something like sleep procrastination, because at the end of the day, you're at home. That feels the moment where you can do, no one is telling you to come to work or whatever. And that's the moment where you put on Netflix. But if you decide to go to bed and sleep an hour extra, every aspect of your life will be just like 2% more efficient the next day.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, well, it's been great, and looking forward to maybe like follow-up studies on this experiment.
We're already thinking of them. Don't worry. It will take a long time, but they'll come.
Awesome. Well, it's been nice talking with you, and I'll see you around.
Thanks for having me.
But do you want to achieve and maintain biological youth? If yes, then I'm looking for more people who want to add healthy years to their life. If you're interested, then email me the word health to info@stephenlund.com and I'll send you the details.